welcome to the official podcast of the Irish Association of Speech and Language Therapists, the IASLT in Conversation. Today we have the pleasure of speaking with Irene Walsh, recently retired Associate Professor of Speech and Language Therapy in Trinity College Dublin. Thank you for speaking with us today, Irene, and you're very welcome to the podcast.
Thanks so much for having me. It's a great honour and pleasure. Thank you.
We often like to start kind of at the start of people's careers, and what kind of inspired you to become an SLT?
Right, well, I knew from almost InterCert, which is now Junior Cert, of course, that speech and language therapy was the course for me. I can't recall how I heard about it, but I do remember thinking this is the perfect combination of kind of medical area, the basic sciences, along with speech and communication, because I had been doing speech and drama since I was 4 years old. So I wanted to combine kind of the medical world, if you like, with a passion around communication and speech and language. So when I came across this course, which would have been now in 1977, it was, oh my goodness, I didn't know that even existed. And in those days, for us, certainly at my age, it was like, you know, you went to college or you went to the bank. And I didn't particularly want to go to the bank. So I decided I'd apply for the course. And then 3 interviews later, and a long time of processing, I was accepted. I started when I was 17. So that wasn't today or yesterday either. So, yeah.
And what was the course like? You know, back then, was it in Trinity only?
We were the first year in Trinity, so 1979 we started, and it was the first year that the course had moved into Trinity. So we were kind of excited about that, obviously, being on campus. However, to be honest, it was a all-female course, and we were very much, I suppose, I would say, isolated on Pier Street in those early days, because our entrance wasn't directly onto campus. However, we did do lectures with med students, OT and physio, etc., which was actually great. And we did get a chance to kind of spread our wings a little bit around campus, but it was a very kind of very, very closed in some respects. But we got on with it, and, you know, we enjoyed it. And of course, being in the centre of town was just fantastic, and the social life was very good.
Great. And I'd say that, as you said, kind of meeting up with other students from different areas was probably more helpful than being kind of sidelined in one area.
Well, absolutely. You see, the alternative was you were out on Merrion Road beside Vincent's Hospital. So here we were in the middle of the city. Which was great, and it gave us a great opportunity, if you like, to educate others about what we were doing, because nobody had a clue what speech and language therapy was. So you spent your time explaining what you were doing. You know, even at the social events, you met other students, what course are you doing? And you'd explain it, and then you'd have to really define. So that was a big part of our role in those early days, because honestly, they really did not have a clue, because obviously the Trinity course was the first course as well in Ireland, and so relatively unknown. So it was tough going in those days. Yeah,
absolutely. That's really interesting. And I know your kind of role has evolved over the years. So from clinician to professor, yeah. How did that kind of come about?
Yeah. So like yourself, I went straight into CAMHS, Child and Adolescent Mental Health, which was my absolute passion, and I loved it. In those days, again, you could get sponsored for your final year in college, and I was sponsored with the princely sum of 500 Irish pounds, which was a lot at the time, because I obviously had to work through my college years part-time to pay fees and costs and whatever. So I was sponsored, having had a placement in the St. John of God's, which is now Lucina. They sponsored me for my final year, having had my final placement there. So that was a real, I suppose, plus, because I stepped into work immediately. I think we got our results early June and I started working late June. So straight into work. And I was committed to the Lucina to work for them for, I think it was only a year because of the sponsorship. But I ended up staying 11 years. So I loved it. And I worked in initially Lucina Rathgar, and then I moved to Lucina in Tallaght, and then eventually I moved to Clonmara Family Centre in Blackrock over those 11 years. And I suppose what I loved most of all was the multidisciplinary team, and the children, of course. The team were fantastic, and I felt my education just continued as I was working, because you were learning something new every day, and I absolutely loved it. So then I still remember children and families that I worked with, because they do impact you in very significant ways, I think. And I also felt at that point, actually, that it all began to make sense for me, speech and language therapy, working in CAMHS. It was like it broadened it out for me so hugely. And I really kind of began to understand the huge significance of our role. So then, during the latter years of being there, I think I began to think I need some more information, I need some more training, I need some more education. So I decided to go back to college and do an MPhil in linguistics. So after 10, I think it was 10 years or so, I went back and did my MPhil in linguistics. And that was kind of a little bit unusual for speech and language therapists to kind of take a step back or sideways almost to focus on theoretical linguistics. But I felt I hadn't enough grounding. I really wanted more and more theory to really understand the children and their complexities that I was dealing with. So I went, and that wasn't in the speech and language therapy department. It was in Centre for Language and Communication Studies in Trinity, which wasn't part of our school at all in those days. So I think I was the first SLT to do that MPhil, and then there was been a trickle of SLTs doing it, certainly in recent years after I did it. And I enjoyed that. And while I was doing that, so that was part-time on top of work, and you know how busy work can be and how traumatic some days can be, but it was lovely to leave the clinic and go in for the evening into college and sit and listen to lectures. So while I was completing that, a job description came up from the Department of Clinical Speech and Language Studies in Trinity, and I thought, oh my goodness, that I felt it was written for me. And yet I knew that, I've a lot of work to do even to apply for this or to get a chance at it. But I decided to throw my hat into the ring, because it just seemed very attractive to start working with students and teaching students. And although I loved my clinical work, I knew that I possibly could still continue on some clinical work as well. So I wasn't leaving it behind completely. So anyhow, I was lucky enough to get the job, and I started in Trinity in 1993. So, and then I retired in 2023. So it's a 30-year teaching period in Trinity, which was an education in itself. I mean, again, I was very lucky to have strong people around me, lots of support, lots of scaffolding. I learned as much from the students as I hope I taught them. Loved being around students, loved the challenges, which I know we could talk about in a moment. But so that's how I ended up in Trinity. And then in those days, you were like, nowadays you wouldn't get a job in a university without a PhD. So all I had was my MPhil, my master's in theoretical linguistics. So I kind of knew that I was going to be shoved onto the PhD register very quickly, which I was. So I was kind of, coerced onto the PhD register very quickly, which, in hindsight, I was very glad about. But I was trying, at those days, I was trying to start a new job, trying to teach for the first time, trying to use even an overhead projector and a computer, which in those days was a Oh, huge. And meanwhile, I was expected to be doing a PhD.
That's a lot, yeah.
That was a lot. It was a lot. But I suppose I took on the challenge and got my PhD because you're kind of expected. So and then yeah, and then I suppose after that, yeah, I've worked in the department for that length of time, up until 2 years ago. So
And you
it's
mentioned your PhD and kind of research projects that you've been involved in. Is there any that kind of stands out throughout your time?
Yes, it does actually, big time, really. While I was trying to decide what I was going to do for my PhD, because my master's had focused on assessment of pragmatic skills in childhood. And come to PhD, it was like, what am I going to do? But I always had this, I suppose, question in my head. That arose from working with children with mental health disorders is what happens to them when they grow up. And I was so interested in adult psychiatry. And I just decided to start delving into adult psychiatry from a communication and language perspective. And of course, people were saying to me, oh, you know, you're crazy. You know, your undergrad and your master's were in child focused. Why are you suddenly, you know, going into adult? And I said, well, I want to learn something new and I want to challenge myself. So I started, you know, putting out feelers, and I had the great honor and privilege of going to Broadmoor High Security Hospital in the UK, which in those days is for the what they call the criminally insane, which is a terrible phrase, but that, unfortunately, that's the phrase. And who was working, Jenny France was the speech and language therapist working in that environment. And I thought this, all my birthdays had come at once. She invited me over to spend a couple of weeks with her and to shadow her. And then I began to learn about the potential for our role in adult psychiatry, which in Ireland at that time was not happening, other than maybe, you know, in very bespoke or very particular settings, but certainly not pervasive. Possibly in, you know, old age psychiatry, maybe dementia care, that sort of thing, but not in your area like schizophrenia or depression or anxiety. So anyhow, spent some time with Jenny, who became a really good friend of mine, and that kind of put the fire in my belly. And then I came back and decided, right, that was going to be my PhD area. So I worked in the area of schizophrenia. And while doing that, I realized I worked in a high support hostel for chronically ill adults who had been hospitalized up to 25, 30 years, and then were discharged into the community and expected to get on with it. And some of them were so institutionalized they couldn't buy themselves a cup of coffee in the local cafe because they just, you know, were so, I suppose, so institutionalized. Anyhow, I started bringing students out to that setting. And I suppose starting to do group work, conversational skills work, you know, social skills, all that kind of area, pragmatic language skills. And then I suppose you're talking about the kind of research. Then I suppose that was the basis for my PhD. And then we decided, myself and a couple of colleagues decided we need to do a needs analysis for SLT and adult mental health in Ireland. Obviously, it was just in Dublin for the first while. So we kick-started that project, which was definitely a highlight. And myself and Dr. Julie Regan, who's now head of our department in clinical speech and language studies in Trinity, Julie and Rebecca Soman, and Dr. Paula McKay, who was a psychiatrist, and Dr. Brian Parsons, who was also a psychiatrist, we formed a team and we decided to do a needs analysis. And we did, and that got published. And that needs analysis, thankfully, precipitated the first ever role, bespoke role, for SLT in adult psychiatry. And that was Jennifer Brophy who got that post. So she was SLT specialist, or sorry, clinical specialist in adult mental health. So that was a big, I suppose, highlight. And I was very pleased about that naturally. It was very hard to get that recognition out there though. The need for adult SLT in psychiatry. It was so hard. I mean, I still have the bruises on my head from banging on doors and walls. And, even went into Dundrum, the Dundrum Mental Hospital at the time. It's now moved out to Grange Gorman. But we had meetings upon meetings about getting some SLT involvement in, in those settings. We put so much work into it, and I suppose that's, I know it's a question that's going to come up about the challenges. We got a certain distance, but not as much as I would have liked. But a highlight within that research, and it spawned a couple of publications, all right, that research. And although I'm not a royalist, we did get recognition from the Royal College of Psychiatrists, and they invited us to present our study in poster format to Princess Anne in Harrogate one year, the Royal College of Psychiatrists meeting. I laugh because we had such fun at that meeting. But the fact that it was chosen, not so much that we're going to meet Princess Anne, the fact that it was chosen as a piece of research to be discussed, that was the achievement. So from that then, I suppose, as I say, we did publish a couple of papers, and then myself and Caroline Jago went on to publish a book focusing on that. So I suppose that's where my career, yeah, there have been a number of highlights within that.
Yeah, amazing, amazing. And I suppose it's as you said, it's still ongoing. As I'm in the mental health area, and I know we have two speech and language therapists and adult mental health in Cork, which is fantastic to have them. I know, fantastic to have them. And it's also hopefully going to grow in the next few years.
Absolutely. I really hope so. As a, you know, it's my one, when I look back on my career, it is one of my regrets that it didn't progress even more. We were pushing, pushing, pushing. I presented many times in at ASHA in America, many, many times, at IASLT, at RCSLT. And you got recognition at around that time, and then you got some momentum from that time, but then that would die off again. And you're just fighting and fighting for roles. And I do think I think, I believe very strongly it's linked back to lack of understanding of what we do. I really do. And I think, and I think our name doesn't help. I think speech and language therapist does not help us. So, I still think we have a huge amount of education to do. When we were in America, we presented a lot of times in America, and after our sessions, there used to be queues of people to come up and talk to us. Yes, why hasn't this been, developed? And it was just so wonderful to get that feedback, and at the same time, just things were moving so slowly.
Yeah. And it comes up time and time again. I think nearly every speech and language therapist that I've maybe ever spoken to speaks about the importance of the role of advocacy, for current speech and language therapists, for students, for retired speech and language therapists, just everyone. You know, it's become such I think I thought it had become such an important role, but it sounds like from the very beginning. Like, because I think it was really interesting for you to mention that when you were in college, you felt like you were advocating so much. So it has just continued to be such
Oh,
a massive part.
absolutely. And I always felt that child and adolescent psychiatry was better known, certainly in Ireland, than it was known in England. And then adult psychiatry is better known in England than it was in Ireland. So there was SLT in adult psychiatry in England long before, or in the UK, long before we established our first ever post. First ever post, I think it must have been 97, 98. The study was 97, so it was the late 90s maybe before we established the first post. So it was, yeah, it was a struggle. And as I say, it's one of my regrets in some respects that I didn't get to progress it even more, but it's in safe hands, I know
And
that.
it's still a huge achievement, the amount of work that ye did in advocating for that role.
Thank
That's
you.
amazing.
Yeah. I mean, it was just my passion.
Have you any other kind of highlights of your career?
And I suppose getting a PhD was a highlight. I never thought in my wildest dreams that I would ever be able to get a PhD. Now, it was hard work and I struggled, there's no question, but that was a pretty big highlight. I suppose then the publications have been a highlight, latter years have been highlights. So both of the books, Communication and Mental Illness, Developing Theory, Growing Practice with Caroline, my dear friend and colleague, Caroline Jago. That was 2020. So that's an edited volume. And it was lovely working with people who had shared the same passion and who contributed chapters and whatever. And then most recently, when I had time to finish it, we published another book called Social Interaction and Professional Identity in Allied Healthcare Education. And that was published by Edinburgh University Press. I had started while I was working, but there was just no way I could get on top of it. So we published that this year, again, with Caroline Jago and with Niamh Reynolds, who is now Dr. Niamh Reynolds, who was an undergrad student of mine and a PhD student of mine. So, so they've been really nice highlights because you kind of need some markers, you know, of how you're doing, because we give. And then just sometimes you need, okay, yeah, you achieve that, you know. And I would never have dreamt that I would have got a PhD, or B, that I would have published books, you know, way back when I started.
And actually, your book, your first book, Communication Disorders in Mental Health Illness, really, really helped me. I got very excited when I Googled you and saw that you had co-edited that book, because it was probably what got me through. So I was in CAMS on a final year placement, and it was kind of COVID and everything had happened. That book just is invaluable. So it's a great one to reference.
Good, thank you. I know we enjoyed it, but as I say, it's very hard to do these things when you're working full time. I mean, people think you're in an ivory tower in college, you know, and that you've all the summers off and you've got your weekends off and you're evening. Not at all, not a bit of it. You're teaching full time, and then you're trying to catch up with admin work, and then you're trying to do your research. So it's not easy. So it is lovely to see when they do eventually come to fruition before they go out of date.
And what did you enjoy most about teaching future SLTs?
I think I was happiest in the classroom, to be honest. I love the energy of the students. I love their motivation. I love the fun. I love their questions, some of which I couldn't answer. And we used to have I'll check that out for you and get back to you tomorrow. you know, I remember when I was starting off very early on, being terrified of questions. But then I began to enjoy the questions and discussions. And I think I also loved to see students developing a passion in an area, whatever area that might be. I loved to see the fire in their belly being lit by something, and you know, and growing over the 4 years. I think I really enjoyed that. And then obviously in the final years, you get to know the students a little bit better, because you could be supervising their final year project, or you could be in clinical work with them. So I loved all that.
Yeah. And what is kind of often a topical conversation is clinical placements. And I know a couple of months ago we spoke with Deirdre Kidney, who had won an ISLT award last year, about the importance of, you know, SLTs going on clinical placements and supporting students and new graduates. But is there any advice that you would give to the students that are entering the clinical placements? I mean, I know you've spoken and you've been a teacher for 30 years.
Yeah. Yes, I was thinking about this, and I think, and having just published that book actually of Social Interaction and Allied Healthcare Education, kind of does focus on clinical placements. I feel very strongly that students should be both be themselves and be professional. It's a combination of being yourself and being the ultimate professional. So yes, you may be struggling in an area. Yes, you may be struggling on a team. Yes, you could be only in second year, third year, and you're still learning, but you must be the professional you're expected to be, and you must behave professionally so people will treat you as a professional. And then I think not to lose yourself within that, because I think so many of our students used to leave their own personalities outside the door and then put on this SLT hat to behave in such a way. Now that sounds a contradiction, but there is so much of people's personality that sometimes gets lost as they're trying to be what they think others expect them to be. But I think you can combine who you are yourself with your air of professionalism, which is so important to get respect. And to ask questions and not to be afraid to ask questions. You're learning, you are in the student role. And, to be honest about that, we have a chapter in the book, in the most recent book called Fake It Till You Make It, I think it's called. And we all did it. We all pretended. And you have to do a certain amount of that. But at the same time, you have to be, honest with your supervisors and your teammates that if you don't understand something, you ask, and that you are a learner. So I think it's, to me that, but not to lose your professionalism or your personality within that, because we get such wonderful students. And I hate to see the anxiety sucking the personality out of them, They're so anxious about doing well and achieving well, and sometimes they just lose themselves in that, and I think that's a shame.
That's
So
excellent advice to kind of find that balance between professionalism and
and your personality,
keeping.
yeah, and your passion, and yes, I know there are some placements that you mightn't enjoy as much as others. I remember my own. There were some I didn't enjoy as much as others, but you have to get on with it if you want to be that ultimate professional, and you're there for your client first and foremost. You're there for your client, so you've got to forget, put your anxiety outside the door, not your personality, and
And that's really good advice, I guess, also for newly graduated speech and language therapists or kind of even SLTs who are kind of navigating new roles or new areas, to keep that in mind too.
I think to be open, I think as SLTs, we are a fantastic profession. I'm a bit biased, but we are a fantastic profession. And, we're very committed, I think, as a profession. And we're very people focused. And I just think we have to be true to that, and not get carried away with the what would I say, the cut and thrust and competitiveness of the world, of the medical world and the health world. Our clients sitting in front of us are the most important people at that moment in time.
Yeah, absolutely. How do you think that SLT education should evolve, or how do you see it changing or evolving?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think inclusivity first and foremost. We now have become a wonderful multicultural country. And I think we really need to be inclusive of many, many different cultures, and not be your middle class white female be the predominant demographic. So I would be very keen on seeing that inclusivity being expanded a lot more. I would also advocate, if you'd like, for greater theoretical underpinning of the modules that we teach. And I say that because that's why I went back to do a master's, because I felt, okay, I've learned the applications, but I don't really understand the theory as well as I should. And I think so, it's one of my bugbears. I used to think we'll end up being technicians and not therapists. And I think there's a big difference between being a technician versus being a therapist. So I do think greater focus on the theoretical and then the applications, as opposed to jumping straight into applications of theory, because I don't think that stands to you. I think you then get a bit lost when you meet a situation that's very complex. So that's what I would think. Certainly, there would be my two, I suppose. And it's very hard. I mean, it's 4 years honours degree. I did mine in 3 years. I did a past degree, had the option at the time, because I wanted to get out to work immediately. But now it's a 4 year honours degree. And I know it's jam packed. It's absolutely jam packed. But I, you know, again, I think we possibly over assess and over examine. I would feel that. And, you know, I think we have to give students a really, really good grounding and to allow them to become self-directed learners and go out there then and go after their own learning in the way, you know, in a productive way. You can't teach everything in four years. And it's not about that. It's about education, really. It's education, the person to become that lifelong learner.
It's teaching the skills rather than teaching the
content. Well, content, absolutely, because you cannot begin to teach all of the, you know, so-called disorder areas. You just can't do it, you know. That's why I feel if you get a better grounding in the basic sciences and the theory, mm-hmm. I think you can then apply. I think you can, you know. So that's what I, yeah, rather than just teaching skills, they can be honed in the workplace. They can be honed on clinical placements, you know.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I suppose, I think what I found when I came out of college was that we're continuously learning anyway. Oh. And things are constantly evolving and changing. So
exactly.
Having those skills, and we did kind of problem-based learning in college, and that kind of allowed us to hone those skills. I don't know if that's done in Trinity or...
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, we've done that for many, many, many years. But I suppose it's in a hybrid form now. But yes, absolutely. I agree with you. So that's really what you want to create, is a self-directed learner who's, you know, knows where to go to get the information they need or the training they need. But yeah. I do worry that we may become more technicians than therapists. And that worries me. It always worried me.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, the other area, I never trained in dysphagia. I suppose I chose not to. I did try, but it didn't last very long. In those days, it was optional. And, you know, I would have needed it for adult psychiatry. So those that came after me certainly did get their qualification in dysphagia. But I often wonder about that area. I can see its importance. Obviously, it's huge importance. But it used to worry me that it, you know, a person with a stroke, you know, may not be able to swallow, but they may not even be able to ask for a drink if they could swallow. And I think the communication piece got lost somewhere and dysphagia was prioritized. And that used to bother me. And it's not therapist's fault. It's just the whole system's fault. It's just like it's life threatening.
Yeah.
You know, communication isn't, but swallowing disorder is.
And dysphagia, I guess, is life-threatening in the moment.
Yeah.
But the inability to communicate can also be life-threatening in a longer term.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, you know, I don't think we have the answers. And I have huge respect for those who work in dysphagia, because I could never do it. And, you know, it's become a science of its own. And it's fantastic work. But I do worry that sometimes it's, you know, it puts communication in the shadows.
Language. You don't want to see that get lost, which is kind of our bread and butter, that communication piece,
absolutely.
Isn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah.
I remember one of my first lecturers in college called us communication specialist. And I know you said maybe speech and language therapists can be a little bit, that's always stuck with me, communication is what we do.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And to understand what communication is, I mean, to understand language and speech, you know. I mean, I think we're so lucky to be in the profession, because it's such a rich profession. Yeah.
And it's so expansive, isn't it?
I know, huge. You know,
it's there's just so many different areas, and I'm still learning about all the different areas. We spoke last month to an SLT working in neurosurgery, and away craniotomies, and it was just, wow, it's amazing.
Absolutely amazing. Yeah, and like it's a springboard to so many specialties.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I chose to stay in psychiatry all my career, and I have no regrets about that. But there were so many other areas out there, you know, it's fantastic.
And do you have any hope for kind of SLT as a profession in the future?
Yes, more males, and definitely more males. And I suppose as a profession, better recognition. Better understandings, so that we still don't have to keep explaining ourselves and justifying the roles and the jobs and the positions and fighting for them. That would be my greatest hope. And I can't believe I'm saying this after nearly 40 years, but, you know, it's still the case. It's still the case. Like, people come to me even now for advice around X or Y. And, you know, parents of children, whatever, and even they might be attending an SLT and they don't understand what's happening. They don't understand, you know, and I think there's a huge onus on us to keep educating.
Yeah.
So if that means, you know, going into secondary schools or going into community groups or going into, you know, and just explain, because I think the confusion about what we do does us no favors.
Mm-hmm.
No favors. Yeah. In keeping posts, in developing posts, in asking for posts, you know, and it's okay, patients can be advocates themselves. I still think we've got a lot of work to do. So for the profession, I think I would like a change in name, most definitely. lots of debate about what that could be, but I do think I'd like a change in name.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. And I know you, going back to the kind of advocacy bit, you kind of mentioned a couple of ideas for, you know, going in different places. Have you any other ideas on what could be done?
Well, you see, I think it's up to every individual, to be honest, yeah, in their role, in their setting, even if they're alone therapists, you know, they have to keep talking about what they do and why they do it. Mm-hmm. So I think it has to be each individual.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I think ISLT have been very good with this, you know, press releases and statements and whatever, all of the time getting them out there.
Yeah.
And more publications. You know, we have now got Advances in Communication and Swallowing, which was the journal that myself and Julie, I suppose, it morphed from the Journal of Clinical Speech and Language Studies. I was editor of that for nearly 15 years with Martine Smith. Professor Martine Smith, we were editors for that for a long, long time. We took it over from Margaret Leahy way back when. But that now is Advances in Communication and Swallowing, which is the ISLT journal. And that's a great place to put ourselves out there, because now that is indexed. It's on Google Scholar. It is out there. So that will educate people about our role, because obviously all the different, you know, contributors in there. So it's that kind of publications. We used to have the magazine Update. Is that still with ISLT or is it gone?
I believe that's gone, but there is kind of an email kind of that goes out about and things like that.
But I suppose the public facing aspect is probably the most important then beyond that, you know,
yeah,
is to get those articles in the paper or the press releases or the open days or the, you know, launch of certain initiatives, those kinds of things,
yeah,
into the media, and not just when something's gone wrong, but when something's gone right, because unfortunately it can be when something's gone wrong that
it's often negative news rather than positive, isn't it?
Yeah.
Great. So do you have any advice for someone coming up to retirement or is recently retired?
Well, personally, I was ready. I mean, I knew I was ready. And I suppose I put a lot of prep in, but I didn't think that long about it. But coming up to retirement, I think what's lovely is that suddenly you have time to think. For me, the big thing for me is what I call the silence in my brain. And it allows me to think about other things. And, you know, you'll always be a speech and language therapist and you'll always have that interest in communication and language, which I still have. I mean, I still have, and I, you know, I have my toes in a few things. So I think nurture that, but you can nurture that in a way that isn't pressurized anymore.
Yeah.
And I think enjoy that, you know, like we have a group called SLTs for Humanities. That is, it's a very small group, small network of current SLTs, retired SLTs, student SLTs who join online every 6 weeks for this discussion of maybe a piece of poetry or a piece of art that we've seen or a novel or some fiction around that references speech, language, communication, swallowing, anything to do with our profession. So I would urge, you know, those who are retiring, you can never, you know, not become, you can never suddenly not be an SLT. And if you still enjoy those areas, pursue them in different ways. And I suppose what I'm enjoying too is, you know, I'm getting time to exercise, I'm getting time to swim, to walk, to do lots of things. So to keep active, but also to support our profession in the ways that we still can do at a distance, but
yeah, maybe in a less pressurized kind of vacuum.
Yeah, but you know, it is, I think if you have the passion, you never lose the passion. So you do, it's lovely to be able to just delve into something without having to submit a paper or having to write an exam or, you know, suddenly.
Do it for the joy of doing it rather than a deadline.
I'm still slow, to be honest. I'm very slow to read for pleasure as much as I thought I would, because the printed word was so much part of my career and it's kind of like I want to rest from it. But yeah, and I'm doing some community work, I'm doing some voluntary work, and I would say get involved in volunteer, because we have skills of bringing people together, and I enjoy that. So I would say to people, get involved, give yourself a break for a couple of years and then just get back involved in whatever, when and if you feel like it.
Absolutely. And just for the last question,
sure.
We like to hear from kind of members of the IASLT about what you think is the best part of being a member of the IASLT.
Mm. I think I loved the safety net that it used to provide for us, or for me. I'm talking, I suppose, you know, during my career. I always felt ISLT would have my back, or would support me, or would be there, you know, because it's different. Your workplace environment is different, but to have your professional association there to back you and also to guide you through maybe publications or position statements or whatever, I think all of that was very, very important for me. During my career. And I think the sense of the collective, that we're all in this together and we're all, you know, fighting for the same thing, you know, and then, you know, running conferences or being part of larger associations like ASHA, I really enjoyed that over the years, or IELP, it's got a different name now, I'm not quite sure of the full title, but there are different, you know, associations, and that ISLT were part of all of those. And I enjoyed that piece because you were recognized then. You had another badge of identity when you went places, you know, and I liked that very much. So, yeah, I think it's the sense of the collective for me. Yeah, definitely.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. I suppose that brings us to the end of today's conversation. Thank you so much for joining us. And especially big thank you to our guest for sharing her experience in the world of SLT. If you enjoyed today's episode, don't forget to tune in to ISLT in Conversation, where we continue to explore the stories, science and voices shaping speech and language therapy in Ireland and beyond. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time. Thank you.